You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Good morning. You're on 855-3CR, Radical Radio. And this is our summer programming on 3CR. This is a time when our regular broadcasting team take a break, and we're bringing you some highlights from 3CR's current affairs programs. Up first, we're going to have a listen this morning to a conversation between our regular Thursday breakfast presenter Priya and Professor Nicholas Davis from the University of Technology in Sydney, talking about artificial intelligence. This original interview ran on the 17th of August in 2023, which sounds like a while ago, but that's when 3CR aired a special week of interviews and information about AI. This particular interview is about artificial intelligence regulations in Australia and is still enormously relevant in the critical discussion around AI and privacy.
And we are now joined by Professor Nicholas Davis, who's an industry professor in emerging technology at the University of Technology, Sydney, as well as co-director of UTS Human Technology Institute, along with Professor Edward Santo. And Nick is joining us to speak about what it means to regulate the use of artificial intelligence in Australia, including the regulatory mechanisms that we already have in place pertaining to AI. So earlier this week, Nicholas co-authored a conversation piece with Ed Santo and Sophie Farthing, head of the Policy Lab at the Human Technology Institute, which provided further insights into the tech sector's backflip on regulation and the issue of enforcing both existing and future regulatory mechanisms in the face of increasingly widespread AI use across various sectors of Australian industry and society. The Human Technology Institute is a new initiative situated at UTS, which aims to build Australia's capabilities around the ethical and responsible use of artificial intelligence. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Priya.
Thanks so much for joining us today. So I might start with something that happened a little bit earlier in the year. So yourself and Lauren Solomon were both leads on the State of AI Governance Report, which was released earlier this year and explored the state of AI uptake and governance in Australia across a diverse range of sectors. So to begin with, can you tell us a bit about some of the industries or intra-organizational areas in Australia where you're seeing a rapid increase in the use of AI?
Sure. I think every industry in Australia is rapidly increasing its investment in AI, partly driven by a huge amount of interest in the latest techniques such as generative AI. But in reality, we spoke to hundreds of companies and government organizations, civil society organizations, and while about two-thirds of them said that they were either currently using or expanding their use of AI systems, when we dived a little bit deeper into that, we found that, you know, it was difficult to find an organization that wasn't using AI in some form. Of course, because AI is such a broad area, and even something like route optimization software, the use of translation systems online, cybersecurity systems, they often rely heavily on AI. Mm. But when we talked about, you know, what were the really hot areas of expansion, customer service, marketing, human resources, and back office kind of administrative processes were probably where most organizations are spending a lot of time thinking about how to use AI in new ways.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's something that, you know, as consumers, a lot of people might be familiar with hitting a wall in terms of customer service with systems that have been automated. And I think there are also, you know, those broader concerns about digital rights and privacy that that this raises, you know, for those areas that AI may be interfacing with more sensitive data. So the report that we've been discussing notes that far from operating in a regulatory vacuum, the use of AI in Australia is actually subject to a range of different types of regulations. So could you outline some of the regulatory mechanisms we already have in place that bear on the use of AI with maybe a particular emphasis on those concerns of digital rights, privacy and surveillance?
Sure. It's a real misnomer, I guess, coming from public discussions of AI that Australia doesn't have AI laws. Because while we don't have specific laws addressing AI systems at the moment, not yet at least, We do have a huge range of laws that govern and apply to organisations as they use AI. And as you point out, some of those relate to privacy and surveillance. So we have, you know, the Privacy Act, and in Victoria there is the Surveillance Devices Act, which protects against optical and data and tracking and listening surveillance, et cetera, in the workplace and in other contexts as well. So any organisation deploying AI, you know, probably first and foremost needs to be looking to its privacy obligations. And given that the federal government is pushing now forward with discussions on privacy reform, and the Attorney General released a report on that recently, I think it's really likely that you know, that'd be an area of greater focus. But equally, look, consumer protection, kind of misleading conduct, and all the work that the ACCC does, work health and safety, where systems might be able to harm someone, discrimination law, and the rights around making sure that people are treated fairly, you know, as a regulator from the, you know, the Human Rights Commission, etc. These all apply to AI systems. They haven't been enforced yet, Priya, to the extent that, you know, those of us working in this area would like to see. But nevertheless, they're there, and they constitute a real meaningful obligation for organisations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has been quite interesting as well, considering that there's been regulatory pushback from the tech sector for a while, you know, and this idea that the tech industry is pushing the frontiers of development, and tech utopianism needs to proceed before adequate regulation can be in place. And now, you know, in the piece that you co-authored for The Conversation this week with Ed Santow and Sophie Farthing, you've noted there's been a recent backflip on AI regulation, where people like Sam Altman, the chief executive of ChatGPT, has all of a sudden become a new advocate for tech regulation. So why the sudden change, and what does this have to do with the increasing use of large language models like ChatGPT?
I think there's a few things at play here. And the first one is that tech companies, like everyone else, like government and those of us, you know, who just are consumers of technology, I think we're realizing how low the levels of trust are in technologies that can be used to manipulate or track us. You know, so when we speak to Australians about specific uses like facial recognition technology or even just AI in general, really it's fewer than a third of people say, yeah, I trust those systems to look after my benefits, and I think they're broadly okay. So two-thirds of Australians are really in the camp of, gosh, we actually need some more protection here, and we don't trust the sector or the technologies to do the right thing for us. So that's obviously a big incentive for tech companies and others to say, well, you know, we want to make sure that we reverse that. Another one is that, of course, some tech companies are fairly self-interested in new forms of regulation, because they've already developed some of these big technologies, and they're able to cope with regulation. So it does remain with OpenAI and others, it does remain to be seen how serious that call is for broad-based regulation, as opposed to kind of fuzzy, off-in-the-future type of controls. And that's why, you know, Professor Santow and Sophie Farthing and Lawrence Solomon and I are really working on these projects to say, let's look after the law and the obligations right now, and make sure that that organisations are feeling that enforcement and feeling that obligation right now in terms of meeting their duties.
Yeah, I think it is interesting to see this backtracking or change in tack from organisations like ChatGPT, where they have been able to, I guess, develop within an environment of poor regulatory enforcement, and are now saying that they're comfortable for, you know, regulations to apply and be enforced once they're in a position to kind of hold their own as that happens. Now, I'm wondering as well about the identification of violations and enforceability of sanctions in relation to regulations. So, you know, I'm wondering, example, for about concerns we've seen about AI-generated media pieces by News Corp for some local reporting, but also about the use of AI within the public sector and how infringements in this area can be prevented or managed if they arise, like another Robodebt-type disaster. So how can these issues be better addressed? And do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, certainly. Look, I think the first thing here is... I mean, from the perspective of helping Australians and ensuring that Australians can enforce their rights in this area, we do need transparency when organisations are using AI systems. Most importantly, when those systems actually affect a legal right or have a legal effect on someone. So granting or denying access to a service or having a decision that someone might base their life on that has a significant financial effect, etc. And those are the kind of areas where, you know, for example, the consumer competition authorities would step in and say, look, if you're hiding the fact that you're using an AI system in a way that makes someone rely on it to their own detriment, or if you're using an AI system deliberately or recklessly to mislead people, as was the case with the federal court's finding in Trivago a couple of years ago now, it's, you know, you're going to be held to a account for that. But for that account holding to exist, people need to know that they've been hurt. And so that transparency and that right to understand how a decision was made or whether or not and what role an AI played in that decision is really important. And our approach has been to say, you know, particularly for systems of high consequence like facial recognition, we probably need a specific provision either in the Privacy Act or in separate legislation that says when these systems are being used, you as a consumer have the right to know, and you as a consumer or citizen resident have a right to redress and can bring an action.
Yeah, definitely. And I think transparency really is key here. And then also making sure that when people do bring an action, that is meaningfully dealt with. Now, I guess, just in view of wrapping up, can you point to any examples of international best practice for digital rights and privacy protections, as well as other protections pertinent to AI use that Australia could be learning from?
Yeah, I think the first thing I'd say is that no one's got it completely right here. You know, China's going a very kind of rules-based, top-down approach. The EU's got a kind of a single act which sets different risk categories, but also has lots of weaknesses of its own. I think that the international best practice that we should be following is getting basic rights well dealt with first. So really following through broad-based privacy protections, surveillance protections, protections around the right of consumers, etc., is probably the most important. And a lot of that is just putting into place reforms already underway in Australia and enforcing our current laws. And then after that, I think a risk-based approach where we really distinguish between how these systems can and do harm people and put additional burdens on people designing and providing those higher risk systems is the most logical way to go, because at the end of the day, we do want to get the most out of AI. We're not anti-technology, we're pro-technology, but we're pro-safe and responsible technology.
And I guess it remains to be seen how this unfolds, but we look forward to hopefully having folks from the Institute on again. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you, Priya.
You're listening to Summer Programming on 3CR. The regular breakfast team is taking a break, and today we're listening to audio recorded from events over the past year.
Up next, this Christmas Day morning, we've got a interview about artificial intelligence and specifically data sovereignty. This is an interview the Grace conducted with Palawa woman and Yuruk Commissioner Professor Maggie Walter from the University of Tasmania. In this interview, also from mid-August of 2023, Professor Walter talks about AI and how machine learning works in terms of racial biases.
I will be speaking to Dr. Maggie Walters. Dr. Maggie is a Palawa woman descending from the Parambinin people of the northeastern Tasmania and a member of the Tasmanian Aboriginal Bridge family. She holds the dual roles of Professor of Sociology and Pro Vice Chancellor Aboriginal Research and Leadership at the University of Tasmania. She is a founding member of the Mayim Nari Wingara Australian Indigenous Data Sovereignty Collective and an active participant in national and International Indigenous Data Sovereignty Networks. So basically, we're going to be discussing today on the paper that she wrote about, co-wrote about the Indigenous data sovereignty. So joining me this morning is Dr. Maggie. Good morning, Maggie.
Good morning, Grace.
How are you?
I'm very well.
That's lovely to hear early this morning. So Maggie, we're going to be breaking down this study you did, report, into about two parts. So we just want to focus first a bit more on like the whole negative consequences of the AI and Indigenous people. So how did the AI, in a way, racially discriminated the Indigenous people? Like, what was the negative consequences there?
Well, look, as you know, AI is about digital technologies that enable machines to perform tasks, and that they do predictive risk modelling, they have algorithms, etc. And they do hold a lot of promise. The trouble is that they also come with a lot of risks. And for First Peoples, it's likely that we will encounter far more of the risks than we will the benefits. Because predictive models, you've got to go back to first principles and say, yes, you've got machine learning, you've got algorithms, but at the base of all of these things are people. Humans write the algorithms. Humans set up the technology to actually do the machine learning, and humans set up, and they have to feed in a whole lot of assumptions. And so that we know whenever First Peoples assumptions are made about us, then it's always going to be negative. So that we are more likely to be represented in the groups for which predictive modelling is done. So we've already seen in New Zealand that you do not even have to think about any racial factors for Maori to be more affected by predictive modelling, because Maori are more likely to be in groups that will be picked up by the police, whether children will succeed at school. So the risks are already there, and the risk is that AI will just be as negative about First Peoples as general society is, but because it's machine learning, people will think that it's objective, and it's not necessarily so.
So I guess the complicated part here for the listeners to understand is how do these algorithms work? And so how do we know whose reality do they reflect here? Like how does this algorithm even operate?
Well, I don't know how they operate, and that's the problem. I'm not an algorithm specialist. I work with data, but I don't write algorithms. But the thing is that the vast majority of those people who are using the algorithms, who are using predictive modelling, who are using any of these technologies, have no idea how these things work. And that's part of the risk as well. Because it's so complex and because it's so specialised that most people using them, even people who know a lot about data, really don't know how they work, and they do not, you know, the old car analogy, you need to be able to look under the bonnet to see what's happening down there. Well, you can't with the vast majority of these the AI. So, yes, there's promise, but yes, there's big risks, and the biggest risk for First Peoples is that we will be further marginalised and further targeted.
I see. Yeah, that's very interesting on that side. And obviously, we also don't know who kind of regulates and controls these like data, like who sets them, what is going, and who allows for these to happen. Is that correct?
That's right. We don't. And well, what we do know is that it won't be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So we know that we are not going to be in the decision making positions, deciding when and how these things are going to be used. So we also know that there's a problem even with the base data. So the base data that have been used and fed into these things are all very deficit-based. So any data about First Peoples in Australia is nearly all deficit-based. It's about how poor we are, how sick we are, how poorly educated we are, how incarcerated we are. So that's the sort of data that is underpinning these AI and the algorithms that are developed to do this predictive modelling.
Mm. And you mentioned also as well in the paper that this is how the Indigenous people are considered as data subjects. So
yes. Mm. Right since colonisation began, data have been collected about us for government purposes, for the purposes of the state. Now, from then until now, the state would say, well, we're collecting these data because we want to help. We want to find out how many people there are. We want to find out how sick people are. But it's the same data collected again and again, and it hasn't really changed since colonial days. And as we can see from the Closing the Gap, despite all this data collection, things have not changed. And it's always a very data that's focused on Aboriginal people, families and communities, without any focus on why people are unhealthy. What is it about living an Aboriginal life in Australia that means you're far more likely to commit suicide, that you're far more likely to have a mental health problem, that you're far more likely even to get sick and die of cancer? What is it about living an Aboriginal life in Australia that leads to those outcomes? And we don't have data on that.
So it's kind of like there's this whole possibly misleading and also very, very misinformed on like the actual reality of the Indigenous people. And obviously with whoever is setting and creating these data, it's not going to 100% really reflect the reality of the Indigenous people.
No, it doesn't. What it reflects is a very, very small slice of Indigenous life that the government or the state is interested in. It doesn't reflect what Indigenous people want to know or need to know. And it certainly doesn't reflect what we need to know for nation rebuilding, for moving things forward and actually changing people's health, people's rates of mental illness, lowering suicide rates, etc.
I see. And you mentioned a bit about, and obviously with all this, obviously we can't really, I guess, argue or try to lobby or like write letters or protests for in regards to algorithms, because this is an AI thing and not an actual human. So you mentioned the hands off.
Where would you write them to, Grace? Where would you write the letters to?
That is true. That's why I was when I was reading your study, I was like, that is true. How are we going to argue about this? It doesn't. We can't really do anything, can we? And you mentioned about the hands off myth of the AI as justification. Can you explain what that meant? I just wanted to know about that. Curious about it.
Well, it's because it's seen as technology. Mm. It's seen as something apart from society. It's seen as technical rather than social. Mm. But it's not, of course. I mean, everything is part of society, and technology does not. Same as Aboriginal ill health, technology does not exist outside of the social system in which it operates, and it reflects that social system. But that is lost, the idea that somehow the technology is reflecting the social system, including the power imbalances within that social system. So they're magnifying the power imbalances. Because it's technology, because it's computer-based, and even the term AI, artificial intelligence, puts it into another realm where it actually isn't, because it's, again, it's people and members of society and social structures and organisations which are actually using this AI for very social and cultural purposes.
I see.
Because it's technology, people think it must be objective. And it must be true. Mm. So if you are running a predictive risk model, the answers come out the end and say, well, Aboriginal kids are far more at risk of committing crimes, then it's not questioned because it's come from AI in the same way that it would be if it was a person writing a paper.
I see. And so now we're going to be going to our second part, which is going to be talking about the Indigenous data sovereignty, which also we can stand it for IDSOV. So What is this indigenous data sovereignty? And can you just give our listeners about a brief explanation of what that is?
Okay, so this my complaint about the deficit nature of indigenous data is not new.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was a major part of people from the United Nations Permanent Forum of Indigenous Forum. Complaints about data have been coming for a very long time. So Indigenous peoples from all over the world, and especially the Anglo-colonised world, like US, Canada, Australia, Tarawa, New Zealand, have all been long complaining about data. So that has that level of unhappiness and the advocacy for change has coalesced into what we now call the Indigenous Data Sovereignty Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And Indigenous Data Sovereignty basically says that it is the right of Indigenous peoples to determine the means, collection, analysis, interpretation, management, dissemination and reuse of data pertaining to the Indigenous peoples from whom it has been derived or to whom it relates. It is about our collective rights to data, about our peoples, territories, lifeways and natural resources. So when that sort of that definition was globally agreed in 2018, but of course even then, even just 5 years ago, AI was not nearly as large on the landscape as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But that same definition still applies, that is about Indigenous rights to data, to our own data, and deciding what are collected and how they are used.
Mm. So basically this IDSOF is a base to protect the rights and the data of what can be said and what can be put out into the actual technological system, and is it in a way like a law to protect the rights of the Indigenous data?
Well, it probably should be a law, but mm-hmm. it's not, of course. But it is a movement of Indigenous peoples, and it's about Indigenous rights, but it's also about Indigenous leadership and Indigenous ownership. So it's not something that somebody else can run off with, some non-Indigenous people, and say, okay, we'll look after your rights. It's about knowing that when Indigenous people are not the decision makers, we do often, even with the best of intentions, get decisions that are not in our interests. So it's about ensuring that when it comes to our data, we are the people who are making the decisions about how they are used. And certainly we should be, if they're going to be, data is going to be fed into algorithms or predictive risk modelling, we need to be at the table making the decisions about how that is done and where it is used.
Mm. And how does this work with, can you give an example of, in comparison with Australia and New Zealand, like just roughly of how does this work basically?
Well, Australia has, we have an Indigenous Data Sovereignty Collective here called Maya Ngari Wingara.
Yep.
And that is a group of about 12 of us. And we work with others as well, but it's a core group of 12 executive members who work together to promote Indigenous data sovereignty, Indigenous rights and Indigenous governance, especially through state agencies, because that's where most of these data are collected and held. We work also with our sister organisations in the US and Canada and New Zealand. And we work on we've just had a Global Indigenous Data Alliance meeting in Melbourne, looking specifically at data held by universities.
Mm-hmm.
We also just held a Indigenous Data Governance Summit in conjunction with the Lowitja Conference in Cairns in June. And we had more than 130 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders in the room, setting down the protocols of what Indigenous data governance, which is the active mechanism of Indigenous data sovereignty, what the protocols are for that to happen. Because you need rules around this, because otherwise, as we know, somebody will say, okay, we'll talk to one Aboriginal person, we'll consult, and then that will be done. And we're sort of saying, well, consulting has not worked for 200 years.
Mm.
In this case, we don't want to consult. What we want to do is have a seat at the decision-making table. And governance has to look like this, or you can't call it governance.
Mm. So this is potentially going to be a very, supposedly it's meant to be a very powerful platform for people, for the Indigenous people to have a say and decide properly and logistically on what can be said and what can be done. So,
yes.
Yep, awesome. And I guess now this comes to just understanding this whole thing with the IDsoft and also the AI, basically. So the IDsoft has the ability to protect, but I guess in a way it also fears the risk of AI possibly risking things that are of discrimination despite the data sovereignty?
Yes, there is, because, you know, these things are being rolled out very, very quickly.
Mm.
And there is a positive belief system in technology. Now, of course, technology does wonderful things, but when you have this sort of positive belief system, it can be very hard to question it. But we know already, for example, that sort of in the United States, that they've already found very quickly that algorithms and machine learning pick up racial biases.
Yep.
And for example, we now have, you know, the ChatGPT, which is sort of the AI which can write essays for you in universities.
Mm.
And what that does is sort of glean through the web. And so a colleague of ours on the Mayam Naira Wangara actually got ChatGPT and asked it to write some essays on Indigenous data sovereignty to see what it would do.
Mm.
And they weren't that bad. But then we realised why. It was because the only material out there about Indigenous data sovereignty is written by Indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm.
So it gleaned and actually got quite an Indigenous perspective, because that's the only material out there. But that's not the case for nearly everything else. And it probably won't be the case for Indigenous data sovereignty once we get other people writing, especially non-Indigenous people writing and perhaps critiquing. So most of the material out there about Aboriginal people is negative. It's deficit-based. It talks about what's wrong with us, how we are the problem. So if AI is scanning the web and pulling all these sources together and then constructing a narrative, that narrative is going to be really, really negative. And I think anybody could, if they're using ChatGPT, could probably run that and actually find out the sort of things that will be said about Aboriginal people from these AI generating machines.
I see. So it just really, it's very complicated here. I guess we can't really come to a conclusion. We can say that, is that correct? That there's risk, but there's so much risk out there in the technological world, in the AI, but at the same time, there can be benefits. There can be benefits to contributing good information about the indigenous people.
Yes, but we're yet to have those explained to us. So I've yet to meet anybody that can tell me how this is going to benefit First Peoples. I'd love to hear that. I'm hopeful that it can, but I'm yet to meet anybody that can actually tell me how it will benefit us.
Mm, I see. Well, Professor Maggie Walters, unfortunately, we are already going to be running out of time soon. So, but I just want to get your last perspective on this. Do you think the Indigenous sovereignty data, this platform, will it be? What is your perspective that this can be very helpful to fully develop possibly in the future on protecting the data of the rights and information of the Indigenous people?
Well, I think I would add my voice to all the others, non-Indigenous voices as well, talking about some sort of regulation of AI,
mm-hmm.
that there needs to be social regulation of AI, there needs to be rules around how it can be used, who can use it, and what are the and the state needs to set these, and what are the measures in there that you put in before you adopt an AI technology to make sure that it does not discriminate and that it does not further marginalise those in society who cannot protect themselves. So it cannot just be allowed to develop without regulations and without policies and without very careful understanding of what it intends to do, and also what are the unintended consequences of applying those technologies to broader society.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Maggie. That was really insightful.
Thank you, Grace.
All right. Thank you, Maggie. You take care.
And that was URIC Commissioner Professor Maggie Walter talking about artificial intelligence and data sovereignty, an interview from a little over a year ago.
...3CR's summer programming. This summer, 3CR Breakfast is featuring extended special event recordings and selected interview highlights from the past year, as well as new summer culture or music-themed breakfast shows curated by our current affairs breakfast teams. Stay tuned to 3CR, and we look forward to returning to our regular programming in January.
Next up on 3CR's summer programming is an interview we did last month with Shirley Hood, talking about Beyond the Bars. Now, Beyond the Bars is a unique series, obviously well known to many listeners of 3CR. Beyond the Bars, live radio broadcasts that give voice to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander inmates in Victorian prisons. It's held each year during NAIDOC Week. Shirley has a very long-running association with Beyond the Bars, and we spoke with her this week about her involvement, why it's such an invaluable project, and also about tomorrow night's launch of the annual CD, which documents interviews, songs, poems, and stories that reach out beyond the bars. Okay, you're on 3CR, and we're delighted to be joined by Shirley Hood, who is going to be familiar to many listeners. Shirley's been a long-time host and driving force, really, behind the annual Beyond the Bars project. Shirley, hi, welcome.
Butter, hello, everyone out there, and hello, Marty.
Great to have you with us.
First, I'll introduce myself. Hi, everyone. Shirley Hood. Nyungar Kurnai Gunditj Tamara. Great to be here in Nam. I'm a comedian and educator and broadcaster, and I am very passionate about giving voice to people who don't always get voice. And because we have got such a large amount of Aboriginal population in the jail system and in the correctional service, that I feel it doesn't balance out, and I've always wanted to give voice to people who have been incarcerated.
And you've been doing it for a long time. I think it's 18 years you've been involved with Beyond the Bars.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So way back in the day, I went back to uni, RMIT, to do a film, media and communications BA. And while I was doing that, I did a unit that was in journalism. And when I was researching social journalism, I came across 3CR's Beyond the Bars. And it was through Kutcher Edwards I saw a part of that. And I went, wow, what is this? And then I went and saw and met up with 3CR, and I proposed my own show called Good Job, The Exploration of Indigenous People in the Workforce. So, and I did that two-hour show for 6 years at 3CR, While that was going on, I got heavily involved in Beyond the Bars. Yeah, and that's quite a while ago.
I think it would have only been running for a couple of years when you first got involved.
That's right. Yes, it was fresh off the bat.
Yeah.
And so it was something new, and it was just, I think it had been running for 1 year. The CD, it was their first year.
Mm.
And it's great to see, like, Shawnee Braybrook involved, Gilla McGuinness, legend, and Kutch Edwards, legend. With Rossy Morgan. And I was just so happy. And Lisa Blair was the woman behind it at that point, and she went into the women's prisons. And then when I came on, I loved that we could go into the prisons, and I wanted to go and see family. So I went into the men's prisons as well.
And so it's always been part of NAIDOC Week, as listeners will know. It runs at the same time as NAIDOC Week. And the project itself has expanded since those early days, involves now 6 prisons.
That's right. Now we cover a lot of Victorian major prisons, and we go out to the regional areas as well, like Fulham and Loddon.
Hmm. And the project itself focuses primarily on giving voice to First Nations
people.
That's
people, right.
Indeed.
Yes.
And it does it through, it's primarily around storytelling, but it's using poetry, music, art, workshops as well. If you could just explain a little bit about how people get involved.
It's such an important project, and congratulations to 3CR for keeping this continual representation. We've had a lot of Aboriginal people go through the system, and that's all the way back from the stolen generations and colonisation. So we wanted to go and get their stories, like, as a person. When we talk to them about where they first started getting into the correctional cycle, a lot of them begin with, I was first taken from my mother, and then all the incarceration that happened following a child that is no longer with their mother. And I noticed that was a really big issue. And so we decided to follow it.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, the numbers you referred to, they are stark. Recent figures we know that First Nations people account for just over 30% of all incarcerations, but of course they represent under 4% of the total general population. So
yes,
the numbers are stark.
That's right, and it's staggering. In the women's prison also, there's like 33% Aboriginal women, and that's not, it's unbelievable for the amount of our population. We're only 1-3%, and it wasn't right. So as we went into these places, and it was fantastic how we were able to bring in the whole 3CR broadcasting unit and hear people do shout-outs to the community during NAIDOC Week. That's a very important thing. And the main thing we sort of started this was to keep the connection with family.
Yes.
So they know that they're not alone.
How have you seen, Shirley, Beyond the Bars evolve maybe over the years? Because it involves workshops as well, as the conversations and the comments that people are able to provide for the CD, and we'll get to the CD in a moment. But how have you seen it evolve over the years?
Yes, well, it's definitely grown bigger. Mm. We've had a great movement of Aboriginal presenters over this time as well going in, and it's great for broadcasting, it's great for community connection, and it's wonderful and very important to just acknowledge and record some of these stories that are being told.
Mm.
Yes, and then like I've gone on to notice, like over the 18 years that I've been a part of this project, it makes me want to go and do a thesis on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you must because have seen a lot. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Absolutely, and we're seeing inmates. When I started, everybody was calling me sis. People older, and then I've seen their daughters come through.
But you've also, I believe you've also would have seen people who were in the system have actually come back as part of the broadcast and helped with workshops and helped facilitate the whole project, which must be hugely rewarding to see.
That's right. And, I mean, you know, yeah, they definitely are brought in as a broadcast person. And speaking with the inmates, you can see the connection that they have with people who've been in and come through 3CR and into the training and then to carry on doing a broadcast. It's a fantastic process for them.
Mm.
And we also get brilliant conversation as well.
Mm.
If you see, like, we've had one person who's been in a few years now, Chrissy Austin, who was an inmate for many, many years when I first was starting, and now he runs and facilitates these broadcasts.
Yeah, and Chris will be part of the launch on Thursday of the CD.
That's right, the launch on Thursday.
What can
and
people...
which is wonderful to have everybody's thoughts of the whole process. And, like, I found it over this time... I've done it quite a few times, so I understand the movement and the commitment of going into the jails.
Mm.
It's a great commitment from all the broadcasters because you can feel the spiritual, you can feel hunger for culture.
Yes,
in
yes.
there.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that when you are very alone, culture is the thing that can fill your heart and fill your spirit. So it is a place where some people get downtime and they open up cultural connections and like painting and poetry writing and reading, and it's something with them getting connected.
And I imagine it must be wonderful to experience and share some of the highs and some of that artistic endeavours from people, but I imagine you also have to deal with, some lows when people are feeling it.
Absolutely, and that is the wonderful work of the broadcasters because when we go in there, emotions are very raw.
Mm.
And it's through the workshops that we build a rapport and we build a connection with the inmates. So we do the workshops earlier and to build a rapport and to have them be able to speak about really sensitive issues of how they first came in. And I myself understand the different processes, and with the new people coming in and feeling okay to speak about some of these subjects, it makes me think of psychology work that everybody's doing, because we're just balanced on the edge of emotions and how people feel.
Mm.
And then we have to bring them into speaking about some of the hardest experiences of their life. And then we've got to take them back out and make them feel strong. Because you can't walk in and bring up all these hard emotions and then just leave it.
No, I imagine it involves building a lot of trust.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the wonderful work that the broadcasters are really doing.
Now, the launch of the CD, again, listeners will be, many listeners will be familiar with the CD, which comes out each year.
Yes, the CD launch, the highlights.
Yeah.
And because we're at each prison during NAIDOC week every day, doing a three-hour broadcast from, you know, the likes of Barwon, Margonit, Port Phillip, Loddon, Fulham and Villa Park, Bang Phillips Frost.
Yes, there's a lot to draw upon.
That's right. So 3 hours each in those places. What we do is we do a highlighted CD, which collates a lot of the stories, poetry, music, different thoughts, different shout-outs, and we put it into one CD and do a launch. And that's what's happening this Thursday. And it gives a chance for everybody to catch up on all the stories that have been told.
That's fantastic. And that launch is happening, as you said, on Thursday at the Gearing Centre in Collingwood,
yes,
the Town Hall.
That's right. This Thursday at the Gearing Centre, which is behind the Collingwood Town Hall.
Fantastic.
So behind Collingwood Town Hall, there's a court at the end behind. So if you drive around.
And you're going to be joined, as you said, you mentioned Chris Austin. You're going to be joined at the launch with Chris and Kieran Stewart-Asserton. And music, some music from the great Bart Willoughby.
Yes, from the legend Bart Willoughby.
Yes, the legend
Bart Willoughby. So that is something. And we have survived. And it's great to have Bart down, such a legend, to have Bart coming and joining in a great night. We're also going to have panels that are going. We're also going to have Robbie Thorpe, the Honourable Robbie Thorpe.
Fantastic.
So, and we've got 3CR down there, and I'm going to be emceeing. So if you have a chance, come and catch up with broadcasters that will be there and all the thoughts around Beyond the Bars for 2024.
Sounds great. Shirley, thank you. You've been really generous with your time. It is such a remarkable project and you've been involved for so long. Thanks for sharing your thoughts about it. Any final thoughts before we let you go?
Yes. Just what I want to say, what I say to our inmates, they can lock up our body, but they can't lock up our spirit. And for everybody, just to, if you've got people inside or if you have any sort of interest in what's going on in your community, please come down and join in this really important launch from 3CR.
Terrific. Thanks. Thanks again, Shirley. Thanks so much.
Yes. Keep an eye out for Beyond the Bars. Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having us on the show.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
This song here is it's on the album. It'll be coming out pretty soon. On the Wrong Side of the Road. Hope you like it.
In this interview from March, Grace spoke with Kurdish-Iranian independent scholar and educator Seva Naqshbandi about the history of music resistance, the role that coded singing plays in activism and resistance against oppression, and as an act of survival. The conversation is in two parts and includes selected songs Seva uses to explore coded singing and its impact.
Thank you so much, Sewa, for coming on to Wednesday Breakfast. Could you start off by telling us a bit about what coded singing is?
All right. Hello. I'm deeply honored to join you today to discuss the remarkable capacity of singing, and especially coded singing, and with a focus on coded singing and the crucial role of women in this narrative. And the capacity of singing to embody resilience and resistance. So coded singing refers to a form of musical expression that transcends mere entertainment or artistic representation. It serves as a symbolic means for mostly oppressed communities to convey messages of resistance, solidarity, and hope in the face of hardship. And this practice has been particularly prevalent in times and places where expressions of dissent were dangerous or forbidden. For instance, during the periods of slavery, colonization, or oppressed regimes, marginalized communities often turned to music and coded singing as a covert tool to voice their grievances and share information, and also to foster a sense of unity. Coded singing takes various forms, including hidden meanings in the lyrics, subtle changes in melody or rhythm, or it could be the use of metaphors and symbolism. So by embedding messages within the music, individuals could communicate ideas that would otherwise be censored or suppressed. So this allowed for a form of resistance that could transcend the limitations imposed by the oppressive authorities. Yeah, this is what coded singing is. And also, coded singing served as a unifying force within the oppressed communities, fostering a shared identity and a sense of belonging among those who could decode the hidden messages. So in this way, music became a powerful vehicle for building and strengthening a collective spirit of resistance. The messages conveyed through coded singing often revolved around themes of freedom, justice, and they could also provide coded instructions for actions or strategies that would help the resistance movement.
And so what is the relationship between music and resilience, and how does singing act as a medium to express and embody resilience, especially in the context of oppression and colonization?
Well, in the context of historical oppression and struggles of colonization, the capacity of singing to embody resilience and resistance is tied to its profound ability to tell stories and to express emotions. So in those contexts, music served as a narrative medium, weaving stories and tales of triumph, struggle, and resilience through its lyrics and its melodies. And yeah, today I'm going to share two examples illustrating how singing possesses the power of narrating stories that deeply resonate with the human experience. And whether through lyrics or through melodies, the essence of challenges faced by individuals or communities can be expressed through singing. So these stories often became a reflection of resilience to illustrate the human capacity to overcome adversity. Singing becomes a powerful vehicle for conveying strength, hope, and the indomitable spirit of those who face hardships.
Did you want to go into some detail about those examples where coded singing contributed to resilience and resistance within certain communities?
Of course. So, well, the first example is what is known as spirituals or slave songs during the period of slavery in the United States. So some songs from this era often carried coded messages that conveyed information about escape plans and routes to freedom or general resistance against the oppressive system. So, as I mentioned, referred to as spirituals or slave songs, these compositions served as a means of communication among enslaved individuals. And the messages were cleverly hidden in the lyrics and melodies, allowing slaves to share information without their oppressors understand the true meaning behind them. A well-known example is the spiritual entitled Follow the Drinking Gourd, believed to have been used to provide guidance for fleeing to freedom. This traditional folk song became integral to the Underground Railroad So Underground Railroad was a network helping enslaved African Americans in reaching free states and Canada. The lyrics of Follow the Drinking Gourd contain covert instructions for escape using coded language to direct slaves toward liberation.
You know, it took a civil war to set the slaves free, but long before that, slaves were escaping in large numbers. This particular song, Follow the Drinking Gourd, tells the story of this Underground Railroad. There used to be lots and lots of verses, but now there are only three. Follow the Drinking Gourd.
Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for a carry to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for a carry to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Now when the sun goes back and the Bruce Quill calls, follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry the freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry the freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Now the river bank will make a mighty good road. The dead trees will show you the way. Your left foot, your big foot, traveling on you just to follow the drinking gourd. Follow.
So what are some of the meanings behind the lyrics in Follow the Drinking Gourd?
The term drinking gourd in the song symbolizes the Big Dipper constellation, which is a group of stars, specifically the North Star, serving as a navigational beacon for escaping slaves. The song advises following the North Star's direction to find the path to freedom, which is a crucial message for those seeking liberation, as the Big Dipper points to the North Star near the North Pole. And Follow the Drinking Gourd provides advice on escaping slavery by using nature and landmarks as secret cues. For example, the initial verse suggests that when the sun goes down and the first quail sings, it's time to follow the drinking gourd. So this indicates that the night is better for escaping and avoiding pursuers. Another example is the next verse, which is describing the riverbed as a makeshift route, which dead trees serve as markers, providing tangible directions for the slaves. And in the third verse, the song mentions reaching the end of the river between two hills, a sign to cross over, indicating a crossing point. This advises continuing the journey along another river once crossed and suggesting a safer path. Following the Drinking Gourd is a powerful song mentioning all these details that not only offered practical guidance for escaping slavery, but also symbolized hope and resilience for those pursuing freedom.
The vocals are beautiful, and it's it seems, I love how nature served as a way of indicating and communicating these messages. There's a lot about the relationship to the land as well for people, I imagine.
Exactly.
Which is obviously so different to the way colonizers look and oppressors like look at land.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're on 3CR's summer programming. That was Kurdish-Iranian independent scholar and educator Serva Naqshbandi, the first part of an interview we ran originally in March, and this is the second part of that interview.
And what role has coded singing played in conveying messages of resistance in Palestinian communities and in Palestine?
The examples that I provide today are the historical examples. Before we go through those examples, those beautiful songs, I would like to introduce you to a Palestinian musical tradition called Tarawid in a plural form, or Tarida in a singular form, predominantly performed by women. And this musical form served as a powerful avenue for expressing both joy and sorrow, holding significance not only in wedding celebrations and other life occasions, but also in conveying emotional, festive, and even political messages, which is the case in today's conversation within Palestinian culture. So the traditional singing form of Tarawid involves continuously repeating a melody, which serves as a coded language or a method of conveying encrypted messages to those confined in prisons. The origins of this form of singing predate the establishment of Israel in 1948, and tracing back to the era of British colonization, when numerous Palestinians were unjustly imprisoned for protesting British rule. For example, to further encrypt the messages, the women would insert the letter L, lam in Arabic, between words and letters repeatedly to create a semblance of gibberish or an unfamiliar dialect to the occupiers. To just picture the context, during the time where a significant number of Palestinian women found themselves with relatives, including their brothers, fathers, husbands, or sons, unjustly imprisoned. So these women would walk along the outer walls of the prisons, singing these traditional songs as a means of communicating with their loved ones who were in the prisons. So from the perspective of the occupiers, it appeared to be a mere Palestinian woman just singing folk songs, and they were unaware that she was covertly sending messages about assisting her loved ones to escape from the prison. In one version of this song style, apparently a Palestinian woman communicates with her imprisoned father, expressing her longing for him and providing instructions for escape from the prison. So she describes the prison's location relative to their village, guiding her father on the direction to run upon escaping. For example, to explain which direction the front door of the prison he is facing. So whenever he escapes through the front door, he knows which direction to run. she incorporates poetry and also using the letter L, as I mentioned, and she recites, Ala li la li bwa bululum, tiftah shama li la li yar wilulu. Shami li la li ya hawe li la di, shami li la li yar wilulu. Ali li la li bwa bululum, tiftah shami li la li yar wilulu.
What are some more recent examples of coded resistance in music?
Well, that's a good question. Generally, there have been instances where artists have incorporated coded messages into their music. One notable example is the song This Is America by Donald Glover, known also by his stage name Childish Gambino. So you know him?
Yeah, that song's so good. The film clip, I just remember watching the film clip over and over again because he's so animated in his performance.
So it was released in 2018, and the music video for the song is filled with symbolism and commentary on various social and political issues in the United States, including gun violence, racism, and mass media consumption. So while it is not traditional coded singing in the sense of embedding messages within the lyrics and melodies, like the example from a historical Palestinian example, but the visuals and symbolism serve as a form of coded communication. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to mention various musicians also have used their lyrics to address political or social issues in a metaphorical way in some contexts, which could be considered as a form of coded messaging. So these examples can be found across different genres and regions, and they reflect the artists or the individual's desires to express deeper meanings through their singing.
And do you think also just the experiences of the colonizer and the First Nations peoples is so different? So maybe colonizers can't really read into the lyrics in a way that First Nations people can because of their such different positions in situations.
Yeah, of course, because they know about the symbolism and they can code the messages and decode the messages. So in most cases, the colonizers don't understand those codes.
Yeah, excellent. I did want to ask you, so what drew you to researching coded resistance in music?
Well, before I answer this question, I would like to give another example of a Palestinian folk song because I think it's very beautiful and I would like you and the listeners listen to it and know a bit about the context. Can we talk a bit about that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this is a well-known song that is entitled Ya Tal'in al-Jabal, which is another powerful example. And Rim Banna, which is a Palestinian singer, played a pivotal role in introducing it to a wider audience. So Ya Tal'in al-Jabal means, oh, you who climb the mountains. And the origins of this song are a subject of debate. So some attribute its roots to the era of Ottoman rule, while others associated with the British Mandate period.
الجبل يا مول المقيدين النار بين الليل يا من يا من عين للهنا يا روح يا طالعين عين للجبل يا مول المقيدين النار بين الليل يا من يا من عين للهنا يا روح ما بدي منك للكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي ملبوس بين الليل يا من يا من عين للهنا يا روح ما بدي منك للكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي زنار بين الليل يا من يا من عين للهنا يا روح يا طالعين عين للجبل يا مول المقيدين النار بين الليل يا من يا من عين للهنا يا روح.
In this song, poetry, analogies and symbolism were used to encrypt messages, and alongside the eldritch, which we heard in the previous example, repetition of the el or lam in Arabic, the woman aims to comfort her imprisoned loved ones. So she employs metaphors stating that the ghazal trapped inside won't be confined for long. So she expressed it as illa ghazal lil jawin lilikum mahbus bainan lil yaman yaman aynan al-hanaru. So the translation, the rough translation, would be to those ghazals that are jailed inside, referring to the imprisoned rebels. I just want you joy, my soul.
إلا غزال للي ذي جوين للي كم ميدوم بين لليامن يامن عين للهنا يا روح.
And the coded messages in these songs represent a powerful form of resistance and resilience. However, I just have to mention that it is important to note that while these interpretations are widely accepted, the exact meanings of these songs can be challenging to determine with certainty because there is lack of enough records from that time.
Do you want to just go, should I ask that question
okay,
again?
Yeah. You asked what brought me to this world of coded singing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, this journey into the world of coded singing is woven from two distinct threads. After completing my PhD in education, focusing on the design mindset in educational settings, which is a totally different area, I began to challenge my assumptions rooted in Western design practices and theories, and embracing more post-colonial and global South perspectives, which contain diversity of worldviews. So inspired by pluriversal concept in design, I started exploring interconnectedness and relationality in design, which is a missing point in Western design theories. So here is where my musical background came in. I play Iranian and Kurdish musical instruments, and also I sing a bit. So this were pivotal during this transformative journey. And concurrently, tutoring at Monash University's School of Music and Performance kept my mind prepared for the next research journey. So this exploration led me to delve into an ancient and unique style of singing in the mountainous region in Kurdistan, in Iran, which is my homeland. In that region, women play a crucial role in sustaining this unique style of singing and this musical heritage, but they are often overlooked by social and cultural norms. So in this new line of research, I aim to explore the often overlooked contributions of women as silent transmitters and custodians of the indigenous musical culture in Kurdistan, where interconnectedness and interdependence are crucial in the community. So this newfound world of research, which is really close to my heart, led me to explore the literature of women's singing in Southwest Asia context, where I encountered the Palestinian folk songs. So this is the first thread. And simultaneously, reading audiobooks for a Farsi-speaking audience on Telegram and YouTube channels that I created, and I incorporate some context-related music into each audiobook. And recently, I happened to read a book by a Palestinian author, Suad Al-Ameri, narrating a gripping story of a Palestinian woman, which is Suad herself, among so-called illegal workers crossing into Israel to find daily works, so the oppressed workers of Palestine. And the Palestinian folk songs that I used in that audiobook, which I discussed about them today, exemplify coded singing to immerse listeners of that audiobooks in the context of oppressed workers. I highly recommend reading this book, which is entitled Nothing to Lose But Your Life by Suad Al-Ameri. And I think an English translation is also available. So this is the second thread. And then fast forward, a friend of mine involved with 3CR who listened to the audiobook and resonated with the song and the concept of coded singing by women, she suggested sharing it on this program, and yeah, encouraged by her enthusiasm, here I am today. Yeah, great.
we can add the name of the book as well to the
of course, it's fabulous.
It sounds like a fantastic resource, yeah. and book to read. Thank you so much, Selva, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me today.
That's okay. Do you want to tell listeners where they can find a bit more about you and your research on either on social media or website?
Well, actually, I'm not involved that much with social media and I don't have a website, but some of my publications are online, so you may want to find them. As we conclude this brief exploration of the world of coded singing, one question lingers: how might the powerful role of women in transmitting messages of hope, resistance, and care through their voices inspire us to recognize and uphold our cultural and political narratives and struggles? And how might we carry these lessons forward in our journey of understanding and solidarity? Yeah, these are so important questions to me. At the end, I invite you to listen to a combination of the Spanish song Panaderas and the Ya Tala'in al-Jabal, which you are familiar with now. Yeah, it is said that Panaderas was a traditional Spanish song that was sung by women while baking. Panaderas means women bakers, female bakers in Spanish. And the song has a playful and rhythmic quality that reflects the rhythm of kneading the dough. In this song, which we're going to listen to it shortly, Teres Seliman and Sofia Adriana performed a beautiful melange of folk music, showcasing the power of unity and expression through singing. Thank you very much. I'll let you listen and enjoy the song.
جبل يمول الموقدين النار بين
You're on 3CR's summer programming. Hope you have a great day. Here's the Ramones.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.